From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. 9 states are now seeing a significant rise in coronavirus hospitalizations, a trend that epidemiologists fear will continue as more state restrictions are relaxed on businesses.
One of those states is Texas, where coronavirus hospitalizations are up nearly 40% since Memorial Day. That's according to data released earlier this week by the state's Department of Health Services. By Tuesday, the number had reached 2,056, the highest there since the pandemic began. One person who's watching the numbers closely is Dr. Mark Boom, CEO of Houston Methodist Hospital, who recently said he's been watching an array of numbers and they're all going in the wrong direction. He joins us from Houston. Dr. Boom, welcome.
Thank you.
Start by telling us, what are the numbers you're watching and what are they telling you?
Well, we've been watching a number of indicators, from early warning kinds of indicators to some more real-time or even lagging indicators. So that starts with the numbers of infections and the people being diagnosed. And that's clearly been going up in Houston. Associated with that, we're seeing a higher positivity rate. So more of the people who get tested are getting positive tests. And then we're seeing higher numbers of people in the hospitals, up probably 40-50+% from where we had bottomed out after the original peak and coming down. It crept up through most of the month of May, but it's really accelerated after Memorial Day.
You say that it's manageable right now at Houston Methodist, but can you give us a sense of how intense it is as you're seeing this increase?
Sure. It's been a more gradual rate of increase, and although accelerating, we collectively all have learned tons about caring for people with COVID. So the goal needs to be to be able to care for people with COVID and to care for all of the other citizens without COVID who need care. We're managing that very effectively. We obviously don't want to see the increase get in an out of control fashion. We've expected some increase. We've prepared for that increase, and we're doing well with that. But of course, concerned that we don't want things to get out of control. The most important thing for that is making sure behaviors in the community reinforce and support that.
Do you and the other physicians there have what you need in terms of respiratory therapists and PPE and intensive care beds?
We do. We're really, really well prepared from a personal protective equipment standpoint, from a staffing standpoint, a physical standpoint. The caveat being no one is well prepared for a completely out of control situation. That is most emphatically not what we're in right now, but we've seen a very substantial increase that we are now figuring out how to manage and manage well. One really interesting thing is we're seeing fewer people need ICU care on a proportionate basis. And that's an encouraging sign. Some of that may be that tends to be a lagging indicator.
Today begins the newest phase of reopening in Houston. Restaurants are going to 75% capacity. The hospitalizations you're seeing fit into this timeline of infections rising after Memorial Day activities, as you said, and the first two phases of reopening. What would you like to see happen?
We went through the first couple, three gates in terms of reopening pretty well, with gradual increases, expected increases, but very manageable. Honestly, I think the big uptick we've seen is probably because of the general public sort of breathing a big sigh of relief and, sort of behaviors of saying, hey, it's summer, it's Memorial Day, I want to act like this never happened. And we can't do that. I mean, that's the lesson here. I would like to see that we watch through the end of the month and see where the data is going before we start doing any further easing. But the main thing I'd like to see is all of us recognizing we have to figure out how to coexist with this virus for some time, and we cannot go back to completely normal behavior. So the price of sort of opening up the economy and getting to do some things that are more normal is we've got to wear our masks, we've got to hand hygiene, and we've got to do all the different things. They're not fun, they're a pain in the neck, but they are sort of the price of being able to coexist.
We've been talking specifically about Houston Methodist. Your governor, Greg Abbott, said he's confident that there are still enough hospital beds and ventilators available statewide. How do you respond to that?
Right now, collectively across most of the institutions across all of Greater Houston, we share data. We're using about 15% of our standard ICU capacity for patients with COVID. So that means we still have 85% of our capacity that is there to care for people without COVID. So, when we take care of all those individuals, we are using a lot of our normal ICU capacity, but we all have significant surge capacity in place. So even if we can expand our capacity by 10 or 20%, we can handle a great deal more COVID patients. It's going to take a lot of hard work and planning in place to do that. But that's, you know, really why we're here, is to take care of the citizens of Houston. What we need to do is work together to make sure those rates of increase don't get out of control.
That's Dr. Mark Boom, CEO of Houston Methodist Hospital in Houston, and he joined us via Skype. Thank you so much, Dr. Boom.
Thank you.
Well, people who attend President Trump's first rally since the coronavirus shutdown will have to sign a waiver promising not to sue the campaign if they get sick with COVID-19. And the president is under scrutiny for holding that rally next week in Tulsa on Juneteenth. That's the day emancipation from slavery is observed. Tulsa, by the way, also the site of a race riot a century ago where hundreds of black residents were murdered. Let's bring in Washington Post national political reporter Robert Costa. Robert, good to speak with you.
Great to be with you.
And yesterday at a forum on racial inequality in Dallas, the president said that Americans have to work together to confront bigotry and prejudice. And then he said this.
But we'll make no progress and heal no wounds by falsely labeling tens of millions of decent Americans as racist or bigots. We have to get everybody together. We have to be in the same path, I think, Pastor. If we don't do that, we have problems, and we'll do that. We'll do it. I think we're going to do it very easily. It'll go quickly, and it'll go very easily.
Robert, I don't think you'll find a lot of people in this country who agree that solving racial tensions will go easily or quickly. Also appears that the president is increasingly out of step with where the rest of the country is on the issue of race. What are you seeing?
He's also out of step with many Republicans on Capitol Hill. When you listen to the president's comments in Dallas, it's evident that he's isolated from both Democrats and some Republicans, like Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, a Republican and Black American who's working on some police reform efforts. House Democrats have their own proposal. But the president continues to make almost explicit appeals to his political base, many of them, if not the majority, white voters across the country. So at a moment of racial reckoning, he is saying this is an easy problem to solve. But military leaders, Republicans, and Democrats are all sounding a different tune.
Well, one of those Republicans, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, typically an ally of the president, said that he would consider removing Confederate names from U.S. military bases. That's something the president has said he does not want to do. McCarthy also said that he would support a national ban on police chokeholds. So let's talk more about that. Do you expect congressional Republicans to be working around the president?
There's a glimmer that something could happen. Sometimes debates over race on Capitol Hill are often like debates over gun control. Whenever there's a mass shooting, there's a flurry of legislation, and then often not a lot of bipartisan action, that it takes a lot of political capital to get something done. But when you see the minority leader in the House, Kevin McCarthy, talking about a ban on chokeholds, that is something that is getting much more momentum. So is a national database of police misconduct. Senator Cory Booker and others have talked about that. Policing is usually not a federal issue. It's a state and local issue per the Constitution. But a ban on chokeholds in this moment, this fragile moment where Black Americans are saying we can't breathe, it is something that is gaining traction just months before the election, as voters in both politicians of both parties are looking to appeal to voters in the suburbs and other places that are now marching in the streets.
And the president also trying to appeal to voters in Tulsa. I mentioned the campaign rally coming up next week. He'll also be campaigning in Florida, in Arizona, North Carolina, and in Texas. That is a state that he won easily in 2016, but the polls show it is very close. What do you read into the president's campaign schedule?
Well, if you look at the rally next Friday, a week from today, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, that was a site of race riots a century ago. It's still a sensitive place in America's racial history. He's going there, the president is, on Juneteenth, this historic day of Black emancipation in our nation. And so it's made a lot of leaders, white and Black, in this country alarmed that the president is shattering norms and being incendiary and having a political rally there during a pandemic at a time when the nation is trying to heal.
This week, in perhaps what will be a snapshot of what's ahead, we saw problems with voting in Georgia's primary. The next day, Joe Biden told Comedy Central's The Daily Show that he thinks Trump's going to try to steal the election. Let's listen.
It's my greatest concern. My single greatest concern. This president's going to try to steal this election. This is a guy who said that all mail-in ballots are fraudulent. voting by mail while he sits behind the desk in Oval Office and writes his mail-in ballot to vote in a primary.
Going to try to steal the election. Quite a claim, Robert Costa. What are your thoughts on the weeks and months ahead?
The New York Times called what happened in Georgia a full-scale meltdown, malfunctioning voter machines, and it raises sharp new questions about voter integrity. Just 2 years after Georgia struggled with widespread reports of voter suppression in that state in 2018, now just months before the election, you see a lot of concerns about the integrity of what's to come.
That is Robert Costa, national political reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks for helping us keep an eye on this. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Decades before Colin Kaepernick took a knee in protest of police brutality, there were sports figures like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. The basketball legend boycotted the Summer Olympics in 1968 by refusing to try out for the United States men's basketball team. Since then, Abdul-Jabbar has been vocal in highlighting the racial injustices in our country, most recently in the LA Times, where he wrote an op-ed piece called "Don't Understand the Protests? What You're Seeing is People Pushed to the Edge." Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much. Nice to talk to you.
Yes. So, Kareem, your op-ed was a clear message of how we're viewing what happened to George Floyd. And you wrote this at the start of these protests, but now we're in the midst of real conversations about changes to policing as we know it. Your father was a police officer in New York, and before that, your grandfather was a police officer in Trinidad. What are your thoughts on this conversation we're having about police reform? And from your view, what would that look like?
Well, I think police reform would probably make it possible for us to deal with bad cops. And we've seen in the past couple of weeks a lot of misconduct by police officers that are assaulting people who are peacefully demonstrating. You know, hopefully we have the political will to do something about it at this point.
I'm thinking about growing up with a father who was a police officer in New York. We had a black officer talk about the dual consciousness that many of them are dealing with and have dealt with, you know, since the beginning of them actually being allowed on police forces. We've come a long way since your father was an officer, but have you been reflecting on his experience as we take on this subject right now?
Yeah, I have reflected on my dad's experience. My dad made a whole lot of the black Americans in our neighborhood proud, you know, because he conducted himself in a very upright way. And my dad was decorated twice and retired as a lieutenant. You know, I always had a lot of respect for my dad and understood, you know, what it was all about, that the people who keep order in our society have to be a cut above, because power does corrupt.
Speaking about your neighborhood being proud of your father, it really also speaks to having men and women of color who represent the communities that they serve as officers.
Yeah, I think it's really important. My dad became a police officer just when New York City was starting to hire a lot of police officers who were not white. But, you know, there's always the unfortunate circumstances of cops who don't respect people's rights and abuse them. And, you know, I think that's what we have to deal with.
I mentioned Colin Kaepernick. The NFL apologized for not listening to players about racism. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, however, did not mention Kaepernick by name. We also heard from LeBron James and many other sports stars, too. We've been hearing from them over the last few days. I'm thinking about the actions that you and your peers took in the late 60s and 70s. I'm thinking about Muhammad Ali, Bill Russell. What do you think we can learn about that time in history as we live through this current moment?
Well, I think that the issues are basically the same. The way that society looks upon people of color has not been something that has made for a lot of justice. And now people are seeing how bad it can be. Ever since the time I think of Jackie Robinson, you know, black athletes have stood for something and led our community to a better place.
You mentioned we're experiencing the same things that happened in the late 60s, and I'm thinking about you back then. I mean, you were a young, promising basketball star who was standing up for injustices, and you're in the same position now, all of these decades later. How do you keep from being apathetic or really so full of rage that you want to opt out?
Yeah, I am. But, you know, it's like what Dr. King told us. You know, we have to have a real commitment. We have to keep hitting the subject and reiterating what the truth is before we get to the point where the people that we're talking to will listen to us and help us affect change. The demonstrations that we're seeing now are being supported by Americans of all stripes. If one of us isn't free, none of us are free. And we have to understand that and work toward the point where everybody's treated the same way by police officers and the criminal justice system.
I want to ask you about something else. Last week, we spoke with the director of the new documentary Be Water about the life of martial arts legend Bruce Lee. And I read that you were always inspired by Lee's activism as a Chinese man, his pride for his country. It resonated with you. Can you say more about that?
Oh, yeah. Bruce's activism resonated with me, and mine resonated with him. I pointed out things to him about certain events in Hong Kong. He did one movie where he tries to go into a public park in Hong Kong, and they say that Chinese people and dogs aren't allowed into the park. That was actually a sign that was up in Hong Kong during its colonial period, and Bruce didn't know about that. I made him aware of that particular issue, and he incorporated it into one of his movies. He faced the same type of racism as a Chinese American that I faced as a Black American. So, you know, we were totally up to speed with each other on that issue.
It also speaks to this solidarity that we're seeing across races, really, at this time. That time, there was that solidarity during the 60s and 70s, and we're seeing it today.
Yeah, really. I think what we're seeing, LGBTQ people, Muslims, Jews, we all suffer from the same issues. You know, if one of those groups is singled out, it's just a matter of time for the rest of us before we're singled out.
You know, we're in the thick of thinking about reforms. Police reforms are at the forefront of this conversation. This pandemic has revealed health disparities. And your organization, the Skyhook Foundation, promotes STEM opportunities that really get at those educational disparities. Tell us more about it.
We work with fourth and fifth graders, and we try to get them to be aware of where the job opportunities are going to be in the 21st century. And in the 21st century, science, technology, engineering, and math will be the sources for most of the great jobs.
Where do we go from here?
Well, you know, I've been telling people it's not impossible to make great strides at this point now that people are willing to listen. And I've been telling people just to make friends with someone who doesn't look like you. And if you can do that, we're going to get past this problem directly. You know, that's all it takes. And I think that people are starting to understand that.
That's NBA legend Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. We will post a link to his op-ed in the LA Times at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure talking with you, and I hope to talk to you some more.
Many people are now reflecting on their own thoughts about racism in America, as well as those around them. YR Media's Ariana Giles is a college student in St. Paul, Minnesota, and she's been frustrated but also encouraged that we may be at a turning point in our country.
I grew up in St. Paul, and as an African American, I know there's racism here, but I rarely see it on display. In Minneapolis, where George Floyd died, most of the people I've met here are super liberal and white people who care. The murder happening in this neighborhood makes me question the Minnesota I know. The image of Derek Chauvin's knee on Floyd's neck keeps replaying in my head. To me, it represents a metaphor for the experiences that African Americans face daily. Some days I feel like I can't breathe because it's hard for Black people in this country to catch a break. From racism, police brutality, and COVID-19, I don't understand why just our existence often seems threatening. Since Floyd's death, I've felt anxious and exhausted. I've had to take a break. It's too much pressure to deal with my emotions while social media is flooded with opinions from so many people. At 22 years old, I know that to see real change in this country, we need all people that don't look like me to stand up. The response to Floyd's death feels more inclusive, but it's deeper than just showing up to protest with your Black Lives Matter sign. What will life look like when the protests end and the hashtags disappear? Will you still be our voice to challenge injustice? Will you urge officers to abide by their oaths and finally protect people that look like me? These last few weeks have left me questioning my four white roommates. Since the incident, I haven't heard a word from them. It's confusing that they can attend rallies and stand up for Black lives, but can't check on the one Black person they share a house with. I understand it makes for uncomfortable conversations, but it is time. If we don't start this dialogue, we'll continue with a generation of police officers like Chauvin or the many Amy Coopers of our society who don't understand why reporting fake crimes against Black people can be deadly. I have hope we might be at a crossroads for change. So I'm committed to talking to my white friends, peers, and now my roommates about how we can create a better understanding of one another and bridge the gap. In return, all I ask is that white people engage themselves in conversation, be open-minded to hearing experiences they've never had before, and not ignore the signs of racism just because it's easier at the moment. Ultimately, I can only hope for a society that treats me like my life matters.
That was Arianna Giles in St. Paul, Minnesota. Her essay was produced by YR Media, a national network of diverse young journalists and artists based in Oakland, California.
You may have noticed something at all these protests over police violence. There are a lot more white people there than you'd expect. But how long will that last?
This awakening among white American voters, how far are they really willing to go beyond dethroning Trump?
Adam Serwer on Race and Lessons from History. Listen and subscribe to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Some National Guard members are now reconsidering their service, even if that means disciplinary action, after the sometimes violent clashes with people protesting the killing of George Floyd. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame reports for the American Homefront Project.
In California, more than 2,400 National Guard members rushed to major cities as protests erupted following the death of George Floyd. But at least one member of the California Air National Guard refused the order to go.
If I made the decision to go along with it, I feel like I would sort of be compromising, you know, who I am in that moment.
He says his senior command has warned him about possible disciplinary actions, so the guardsman asked to remain anonymous, and his voice has been altered. Though he anticipated some consequences, he says he wasn't comfortable carrying a weapon around people exercising their First Amendment rights. And as a person of color who sympathizes with the Black Lives Matter movement, he says the guard's presence stifled protests.
What we're told is discourage people from, you know, criminal activity and things like that, but that isn't necessarily what is going to be communicated on the ground when you see people, you know, in uniform with weapons, you know, standing around in formation.
He says he joined the Guard expecting to do humanitarian work and was surprised by the call to police his own state. And he says he's not alone.
We have people dealing with COVID. We've had people dealing with, you know, natural disasters and things like that. But to actually go out and be sort of this invading force, like many people are not comfortable with it. They feel like it's not really what they signed up for.
When the protests began, more than 20 states called up their National Guard, and President Trump ordered some units to patrol the streets of Washington, D.C. The president also threatened to send active duty troops into cities across the country. Since then, veteran service organizations and GI rights groups say they've been getting calls from troops asking about their options for refusing orders. Bill Galvin is a counselor for the GI rights hotline.
We've seen a real uptick in people in the National Guard mostly, but some in the reserves. Who are facing call up and who are saying, I don't know that this is something I can do. Some of them have said, I'm sympathetic to the protest, and others have said, I don't think I should be at war with people in my own country.
Galvin says at the peak of the protests, he took several calls a day. Whatever the reason, refusing to deploy can have consequences.
But we do know there's a lot of folks who have chosen not to show. And of course, there's a range of possibilities, everything from a military court martial and some jail time to more administrative kind of punishments that might even include being kicked out with a bad discharge. And it's also quite possible the command could just ignore it. You know, they could say, well, we got enough people otherwise, so we're just going to forget about this. I mean, you just don't know.
The Veterans Peace Advocacy Group About Face says it knows of some 10 service members who have taken concrete steps to avoid deployment. One is an active duty Army soldier stationed in the Midwest. Though his unit was never deployed, he says he wouldn't have gone if it had. The soldier asked for anonymity because he expects reprisal from his command and the public. His voice has been changed. He says some of the riot control tactics used in Washington, D.C. reminded him of things he saw in Iraq, and he says they shouldn't be used against Americans.
To me, it's like that violence that we do overseas is coming back home to roost.
National Guard officials at the Pentagon say they're not aware of any widespread disciplinary actions related to the protest response. They added that National Guard troops deployed to D.C. executed their mission with compassion and professionalism. For Here and Now, I'm Carson Frame.
Need to escape the news for a moment?
Check out Endless Thread, a podcast from WBUR and Reddit.
From mysteries to histories to stories that will remind you of our shared humanity.
Subscribe to Endless Thread on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
The pandemic is doing serious damage to state budgets. Shutdown orders and job losses mean less tax revenue for states, and that's money that pays for schools, road repairs, and health care. Teachers and other state workers across the country are facing furloughs, pay freezes, and even layoffs in many states, including California, Colorado, and Georgia. Michigan is calling for federal help, closing its $3 billion shortfall. Mark Nicole is Deputy Secretary of Maryland's Department of Budget and Management. He's also president of the National Association of State Budget Officers. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And how would you describe the state of state budgets across the country?
I would say that this is about the worst state of state budgets across the country that I've seen in my 19 years in the Maryland Budget Department.
Worse than the Great Recession?
Worse than the Great Recession.
Quantify that. Why?
Sure. So the magnitude and sort of timing of the revenue loss has been quicker than the Great Recession and the overall economic impacts too. So one example here in sort of Maryland, we're looking at sort of unemployment insurance claims, and we've received about 500,000 unemployment insurance claims in 8 weeks. During the Great Recession, it took 72 weeks to get 500,000 unemployment insurance claims. And when you look at sort of the decline in revenue, it's just come so much quicker than it did before. It was obviously over a protracted period. Here, the revenue loss has been swift.
In April, your state comptroller said that the coronavirus could create a $2.8 billion hole in the state's budget, and that's if the stay-at-home order was in effect through June, which, you know, that's not going to happen, of course. But how bad is your budget hole, and what's the state going to do about it?
Sure. So that $2.8 billion was revised down to a range of between $925 million and $1.125 billion for the current year. And for the next year, the shortfall is estimated to be $2.1 billion in lost revenue to $2.6 billion in lost revenue. Since we've gotten that estimate, we have taken a budget reduction package to our Board of Public Works, which is comprised of the governor, the comptroller, and the treasurer. And we reduced $121 million from the current year's budget. In addition to that, we are working with our state agencies diligently to make sure they turn back as much money as possible during the current year. We think in total that hopefully we'll get something like $350 million turn back. We think we can get some savings from the CARES Act. Certain costs are sort of allowable to use federal funds instead of state funds, so that'll save us a little bit of money. And I think the remainder of our balancing strategy for the current year will probably be the use of our rainy day fund. So that's, you know, something that we've set aside in the past. And
how much is that?
So right now we have about a $1.3 billion in our rainy day fund. That's about 6.5% of our revenue. we think we might have to use somewhere maybe between $100 and $300 million to get the balance.
Hmm. So that's your state, but many, if not all states, are in similar situations. Tell me more about what's driving it. Is it the fact that people have lost their jobs, they're not buying as much, sales tax revenue is down? I mean, what's the revenue that you're losing?
When you look at state and local governments, usually about 75% of our revenues comes from sort of two sources. The personal income tax, it's a little over right around 44%. And then the other big piece of revenue is the sales tax, around 30%. So if you look at those two sources of revenue, you know that lots of folks have lost their jobs in the last 1 to 2 months. So that means personal income tax collections, the withholding that comes out of your paycheck every 2 weeks, isn't coming into state treasuries. Hmm. And on the state sales tax side, obviously, with a pandemic, many businesses have been closed. So those are receipts that are also not coming into the treasury. So that's the two sort of big sources that aren't coming in. I would say additionally, our transportation revenues are off significantly. You know, other transportation revenues like tolls and bus fares also aren't being collected because no one is on the roads or no one's riding mass transit.
Well, in some states, rely heavily on oil and gas revenue, right? There's one that I've been watching in particular is Wyoming, where the state's budget shortfall is so big that to close it, they would have to lay off every single state employee. That's a crisis.
Right. It absolutely is. And I would say that Wyoming and many of the other states that are very dependent on oil or other mineral-related revenue are the states that in other years are setting aside more of their revenues. So Wyoming, at the end of fiscal year 19, actually had the largest rainy day fund balance of any state. Other states that have big reserves are Alaska and New Mexico, North Dakota, Texas. All of those states have above average rainy day fund balances compared to the rest of the states.
But nobody wants to dip into their savings account for too long. And many, if not most states, are actually required by law to balance their budgets. What does that mean? Do you think that states are going to be able to get out of this for the most part without major layoffs?
No, I don't. I don't think in the situation we're in right now that most states will probably be able to get out of this without either layoffs or other actions to for state employees. I know that in Maryland, we've implemented a hiring freeze currently. There are many states that are considering furloughing state employees. So that's an option that's certainly on the table for many states. Right now, it just poses a really difficult challenge to get your budget into balance.
In the meantime, should we be worried that, you know, these fundamental city services that we rely on, like, you know, maintaining the roads, picking up the trash, you know, keeping the sewers up to date, is all of that going to start to experience problems?
I would think not. I would think that when governments are looking at what is necessary to do, the sort of the core services that governments do will continue to be done. I think, you know, when states begin to look at balancing their budgets, you often look at, you know, what new services have you added in the last few years and try to either, if you had something new that was going to start, you decide not to start it. If you started something new a year or two ago, maybe you pull back on that. And so you look at those types of things first before sort of going after those core services like, you know, public safety and trash collection and things like that.
But are you concerned about other services, maybe services for the poor or for neighborhoods and communities of color? Because we've been paying a lot more attention over the last several weeks after the death of George Floyd. I mean, I just wonder if certain populations might not suffer more if state budgets have to be slashed.
Well, clearly, services, and we're going to see increases in we've started to see them already in Maryland, the number of folks applying for temporary cash assistance and medical assistance have gone up. So those are things that where we expect to see more demand, and that makes sense in a recession. So we're certainly going to be putting in additional funding in that, in those areas, because folks will be needing more assistance. Obviously, we have to, there are a lot of tough decisions we have to make when we balance budgets, and we try to take all of those items into consideration as we make decisions.
Some governors have called for more money from the federal government. Of course, I'm sure you know President Trump has suggested that states that are in trouble financially are the blue states, and that this shouldn't be a bailout for blue states. What do you think about that? Is that true? Is this just a blue state, red state problem?
No, I don't think this is a blue state, red state problem. But I do think most states feel that, you know, this is going to be, has to be a shared responsibility. We know that we're going to have to use our rainy day funds. We know we're going to have to cut budgets, and we're hoping for some assistance from the federal government so we can sort of do this in partnership.
That's Mark Nicol, Deputy Secretary of the Department of Budget and Management in the state of Maryland, also President of the National Association of State Budget Officers. Mark, thank you.
You're very welcome.
For decades, one of the most well-known leaders of the white supremacy movement was David Duke, a neo-Nazi and former leader of the KKK. He became a household name in the 80s and 90s, and even an elected official. Josh Levin, the national editor of Slate, is re-examining Duke's life in the fourth season of Slow Burn. Welcome.
Thank you, Tanya.
You were 8 years old living in Louisiana when David Duke was elected to the Louisiana House of Representatives. I was a kid, too, and I actually remember him being on TV all of the time, especially during his failed bids for governor and later president. Why do you think it was important to examine his story today?
It's a story and a sequence of events that stuck with me since I was a kid. It was really the first event in my life that I remember where it was pretty clear that politics wasn't a game, that it was something that had real consequences. And that feeling that I had back then never really left me. 30 years later, it's something that I still think about.
You wonder, what was it that made white people want to vote for a vocal racist? But in pursuit of that question, you actually look at Duke's participation in a protest in Georgia. What happened there that is so significant?
In 1987 in Forsyth County, Georgia, there was a walk for brotherhood that was organized by a local man there and then also led by Hosea Williams, the prominent civil rights leader. And Forsyth County was all white, and it had been that way since 1912 when there was a lynching and all of the black people in the county were forced out. The march went off, and it was met with extreme force by local white people, just this angry mob yelling the most horrible things. And Duke went there and sort of proclaimed himself the spokesman for the counter-demonstrators, saying that, you know, we need to keep Forsyth white, that there's no reason to integrate this place, that the way that things are now is fine. And seeing, you know, the numbers of people who were willing to follow that message, who subscribed to that, was, I think, inspirational for Duke. He saw the early kind of, you know, seed of this movement that he would then go on to build in Louisiana.
That rhetoric that Duke uses in the protest is basically, as you said, reclaiming our rights. That resonated with white people who may have not necessarily identified specifically with the KKK. We saw a lot of this in Trump's language during the 2016 election and in Charlottesville. Do you see that through line to where we are today?
Yeah, I mean, one major through line that I see is there is this kind of undercurrent of anger about the state of the world, about being treated unfairly, about the perception that other people are getting things that maybe you once got and that you deserve, that the establishment is against you, and that maybe there's somebody embodied in this politician who's saying things that other people aren't willing to say. And one thing that Duke talked about a lot during his campaigns was everyone believes what I'm saying. I'm just the only person who's brave enough to say it out loud.
So as we mentioned, David Duke ran for governor of Louisiana and even president, and he was originally a Democrat who then becomes a Republican. The thing about Slow Burn is that you all slow down the story and pick it apart. And were there any surprises about that switching of parties that really stuck out to you?
Well, Duke is a very opportunistic person, and I think you can make a connection between what you just identified as party switching and the fact that he switched from being a leader in the Ku Klux Klan to publicly disavowing the Klan and becoming the head of what he called a white civil rights organization, the National Association for the Advancement of White People. That Duke was someone who tried to sense the direction in which the country was moving, the direction in which white anger was moving, adapted his language, adapted his connections and associations to try to fit with those times. And I think his move from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party was one of his most successful ones. And I think he felt like, you know, he had a home in that party. Many Republicans disagreed, but I think a lot of voters found that to be a reasonable match at that time.
I mentioned remembering seeing Duke all over the news and on talk shows when we were kids. But there was a moment when the media made a conscious decision not to give him coverage anymore. You're bringing him into this moment. What is the takeaway and the retelling of David Duke's story?
As we've seen our country evolve or not evolve and our politics evolve or not evolve, I feel like his election and his subsequent success and follow-up races, it feels less like a historical oddity and more like a warning sign. It's a mistake to look at Duke as an outlier and somebody who can't teach us anything about what's going on in our world now or in the future.
That's Josh Levine. He is national editor for Slate and host of the fourth season of Slow Burn, available now wherever you get your podcasts. Josh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.